Was there an Adam? Was there an Eve? Or did we evolve from what we conceived? Either way, we got what we needed when the sun shone down on the Garden of Eden.
Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia all over God's green world?
Well, we bit that apple and the garden was lost, and so we had to work to pay the cost. And so we went digging into the ground and started to burn many things we found.
Yes, we sure did. We started to burn many things we found. That's the wonderful Dar Williams singing with the great Pete Seeger and David Burns, the Solartopia song with the Rivertown Kids on there, Tomorrow's Children, the Grammy winning Tomorrow's Children Hour. We have a very album, CD, I guess we call them in this day and age. We have a very interesting show for you today. The first half hour is going to be devoted to a fantastic new film, a documentary film being made by two wonderful filmmakers, Susanna Styron and Jackie Oakes. It's called Out of My Head, and it's running a Kickstarter campaign, and I'm very honored to have them with us. Second half hour, starting at 5:30 Eastern, we'll be joined by Bob Fitrakis, my co-conspirator for more than 20 years on election protection issues. Today could be a very, very depressing day in the history of American electoral politics, and we want to talk about it at great length. We're already getting some pretty dubious reports from the field about vote switching and things like that, but we will take that up in a half hour. First, I am honored to be joined by Susanna Styron. Susanna, are you with us?
I am with you. Hi.
And good. And we're expecting Jackie Oakes at some point. Is that correct?
Yes. Is she? Okay. You weren't able to reach her?
No, but I'm sure she'll call in, or you can email her to the phone again. But
okay.
We're essentially waiting for her to call, and we'll. But you will do more than well.
All right.
You are a very well respected, established, longtime filmmaker. You and Jackie have been working together for a long time. You wrote did an amazing film called 9/12 about the aftermath of the World Trade Center bombing and its effect on people in New York. Can you talk to us a little bit about that before we get into your film on migraines?
Yeah, sure. That was actually about the volunteer community at Ground Zero after 9/11. And I volunteered down there. I worked down there probably once a week for most of the, sometimes twice a week, for most of the duration of the recovery effort. And
down at the World Trade Center, down at Ground Zero.
Yeah, at the World Trade Center, yes. At the World Trade Center, that site, the previous World Trade Center. And, you know, there were so many people volunteering down there to help the recovery workers and sort of take care of them and provide services and supplies for them and things they needed and comfort. And so when it was over, I realized that I had continued to be friends with all of these people I never would have known otherwise and would not have been friends with, you know, from completely different worlds, and that it was very much a part of sort of the post survival, the post 9/11 survival mechanism for a lot of people who did volunteer down there was to maintain these relationships and connections. And I thought, this is a really beautiful thing that has come out of this horrible disaster, is this, you know, humanity and connection and people helping and taking care of each other. So Jackie and I decided to make a film about it, and that's what 9/12 from Chaos to Community is, our previous documentary.
And where can people see that film?
That can be seen. We have a website. It's 912film.com, 912film.com, I believe. And
it won some awards, right?
It can be.
The film 9/12 won an award or two.
Yes, it did. It won some film festival awards, and it was a Video Librarian Best Film of the Year.
Well, I watched it. I thought it was deeply moving. And it's an amazing thing you did going down there every week after the disaster at the World Trade Centers. And you just seeing the human interactions that were involved in the aftermath and the, working with the people who worked down there. It was a great contribution. And I urge people to take a look at it. And so now your new film, tell us about this film from start to finish. I have seen some clips of it, and it's quite powerful, quite astonishing. So let's get deep into it and tell us. You are the director, Susanna Styron, and Jackie Oakes is the producer.
Jackie Oakes is the producer. Did you try calling her, by the way? Do you want to?
Yes, we are. Okay. We may not have the right number, so you may want to email her.
Okay, well, I just texted her to call you. So hopefully
there you go. Okay, so tell us, please, about your new film and what's involved.
Okay, our film, Out of My Head, is really the first comprehensive feature film about migraine, which many people believe to be just a really, really bad headache, but it's actually a neurological disease which can affect all of the senses and which has a hugely debilitating effect on many people's lives.
Migraine is not just a headache.
Migraine is not just a headache. Migraine is a neurological condition. It's severe headache pain is the most common symptom of it. But usually that is accompanied at least by light sensitivity and vomiting and the need to sleep and go into a dark room. In fact, all senses become extremely hypersensitized. Many people get something called aura, which means that can take many forms. It can be visual, where they start seeing flashing lights, or in the case of my daughter, who started getting migraines when she was 14, which is why I'm making this film, really, it started with her not being able to see. The first time she had one, she said, "Mom, I can't see anything in front of me. I can only see on the side, and I'm really, really dizzy." And then
how old
she grew
was
up.
She at the time?
She was 14.
Now, there had been no prior indication of any kind of condition that would lead to migraines?
No, nothing. And I thought something was happening with her vision, and I called our ophthalmologist, and I described it to him, and he said, "Oh, it sounds like a migraine." And I said, "What are you talking about? She doesn't have a headache." And I was just, semi-hysterical. And he said, "Bring her in," and he examined her eyes, and he said, "Look, these are typical migraine symptoms. Go see a neurologist." And we did. And by the next time she had one, by the third time, she started getting the severe head pain with it.
Wow.
Yeah.
And this was all when she was 14 years old?
Yes.
Is there any history of migraine in her family?
Well, not that I knew of. And that was the first thing I was asked by the doctors, because migraine is genetic. And generally, you find somebody in the generation before who had it. I said no. And a lot of times people don't know if there's migraine in their family because it's such a closeted and stigmatized disease that people don't talk about it. But what I realized later when I started making this film in my research, I discovered something called abdominal migraine, which happens quite a lot in children, which is you actually have a migraine in your stomach. And so sometimes children get severe stomach pain, and that can be actually a migraine symptom. And I was hospitalized 3 or 4 times in my adolescence for this incredibly unbearable stomach pain and vomiting, and every time, of course, they thought I had appendicitis, and I didn't, and I would have all of these tests, and nobody could ever find anything. And I realize now, in retrospect, that those must have been abdominal migraines.
Wow, that's really... Now, there is something I had never heard of. We are joined by your producer, Jackie Oakes. Jackie, are you with us?
Yes, I am. Hi.
Excellent. Hi there. How are you?
Good.
I'm really honored to be joined by Susanna Styron and Jackie Oakes. Jackie is the producer and Susanna is the director of Out of My Head. They have made the award-winning film 9/12 about the aftermath and the various situations that followed the 9/11 terror attacks on the World Trade Centers in New York. Jackie, what brought you to make this film with Susanna about migrants? Do you have any personal or family history involved?
Actually, I do. Susanna, there are probably two things that made me interested. One, obviously, is that Susanna and I had worked on a film before together, and we love working together. So the notion of doing another film together was very interesting. And then I realized that my grandmother had migraine, and I remembered times where, you know, we all had to be quiet and turn the lights out, or she would miss an event because she had to stay in her bedroom, and nobody ever talked about it. And then my sister also developed migraine in her life, and she never talked about it. And when Susanna started telling me about Emma, it was like a light bulb went off, and it was like, wow, you know, here's something that my family was living with, but there was, you know, no communication, no elucidation, no concept of what this actually meant. So that intrigued me, as well as the fact that in doing research, we realized that there were so many people worldwide that had the illness, many of whom, 75% of whom were women. So there was something
really?
About that
is this
combination.
Is this primarily a women's disease?
Yes.
Well, not entirely, but primarily 75%. So
wow.
Yes,
that's another answer. Interesting fact.
I mean, men do get them, and they get them really badly. But it just happens statistically that 3/4 of people who get them are women.
Amazing.
And
so tell us now
you
about
put those
the
two
film.
Things together, it's a women's disease. Nobody's talking about it, and you look at sort of the history of medicine and how women have been treated. You know, within that history, you know, obviously there's something going on there that is deserving of exploration.
Amazing stuff. Well, tell us now about the film and what you hope to accomplish with the film and what kind of shape it's taking.
Well, we have shot about probably about 75% of the film, and we are now raising money through our Kickstarter campaign so that we can get in the editing room and spend, you know, 4 to 6 months shaping the narrative and discovering we have a lot of ideas, but until we get in the editing room, we don't know for sure exactly how we're going to tell this very complicated and fascinating story with a lot of different aspects to it. And then we'll also see, we also have ideas about what we still need to film, but we'll see exactly, you know, where the holes are, and then we can go and finish filming. And, you know, what we want to do is, I mean, the thing that Jackie mentioned, that this disease is so stigmatized. It's such a closet disease. When I started talking to people about Emma, and I didn't know anything, and I didn't know how to get her help, and I didn't, you know, it was so frightening and isolating. And then I started discovering that all these people I know also have been getting migraines for years, and I didn't know, and nobody ever talked about it. And, you know, I felt like even as her mother, I did not give enough weight to what she was going through. I didn't understand how horrible it was. I just had a teenager who was saying, you know, don't touch me and don't talk to me. And, you know, I felt like, you know, maybe she was being a drama queen and exaggerating her symptoms. But then I discovered that it was really excruciating for her. But nobody really gave her, you know, I mean, people do not take this condition seriously. They don't know what it is, and we want to change that. That's one thing for people who are living with it.
If you go onto the Out of My Head Kickstarter page or the Migraine Project Facebook page, especially right now, there is just this outpouring of comments from people who are suffering with migraine or living with it, and the way it affects their lives and the kinds of reception that they get be it from their family or from their workplace, or and the kind of guilt that they have for having this illness that is really, really moving. It's really moving commentary, and it makes it quite apparent that the way people see this disease has to be reframed.
So the other thing that we want to do with the film is that there is appallingly little money that goes into research, into treatments for, you know, an incredibly ubiquitous disease. And there really needs to be a lot more. And that's part of the story we're telling. You know, we're talking to a lot of researchers, neuroscientists, who are trying to, you know, move this forward, and it's very, very hard without more government support.
Yeah, and there also needs to be more advocacy. You know, if you have an illness that people are ashamed of or embarrassed by or don't want to talk about it, it's very difficult for them to then sort of come out and say, okay, I deserve to have, you know, we deserve more attention in terms of basic research and in terms of what the government puts into it. So hopefully the film will also help, you know, the community recognize that, you know, they don't need to be ashamed of this, that it is a pretty ubiquitous condition and that it deserves that kind of support, and they need to try to help get it.
But the other thing I want to say, too, is that this isn't just, you know, about pain and misery. It's actually fascinating. I mean, one thing is it's neuroscience. It's the frontiers of brain science. So that's always really exciting, especially now. But also, we are, you know, we've discovered along the way some amazing kind of cultural aspects of it. Like, there are a lot of artists who have taken artistic inspiration from their migraines, but maybe one of the most interesting or at least colorful being Lewis Carroll. And there is an actual medical diagnosis called Alice in Wonderland syndrome, which is a part of migraine aura that some people get where they feel like they're growing or they're shrinking. And Lewis Carroll got migraines. And it's widely believed that Alice in Wonderland is basically the story of a migraine, and that many of the things that happen to Alice are Lewis Carroll's migraine symptoms.
Yeah, the disappearing Cheshire Cat is actually a phenomenon that happens when about 30% of people who get migraine have something called migraine aura prior to their migraine, and very often that symptom is a piece of their vision disappears.
Yeah, I talked about that at the beginning.
Yeah,
with Emma.
So there are a number of images. Aphasia is another one. So a lot of the gibberish that happens in Alice in Wonderland is attributed to the symptom of aphasia, where people lose the ability to speak properly. So there. The entire book is kind of filled with symptoms of migraine.
Are we still there?
We are not.
I think we lost him.
I think we lost him a long time ago.
I think we lost him with Alice in Wonderland. I guess we should hang up.
Call back.
That number, yeah, and it was 888. Sorry.
Okay. I think it was a while ago because he didn't, yeah. Okay.
It was Alice in, yeah, who knows. Okay.
Okay. Hear you, and I heard Harvey for a second, and now he's gone. Hi.
Could you hear everything we were saying about Alice in Wonderland and all that?
I did not, but I must have been with Alice in Wonderland down the rabbit hole here because we lost power for about 2 minutes. I think we're back on
okay.
Here.
So,
well, we went on and on.
We'll jump back in. Here's what we were saying.
Yeah.
Are you ready?
You don't have to tell me. Let's proceed and tell.
Yeah.
Let's tell people what you want to want them to know.
Oh, you mean
about
we
this
were
film.
On? We the audience could hear us, just you couldn't.
I guess that's the case. If you're talking and everything's good, we're good.
We have no way of knowing, of course.
Well, I asked Alice about migraines, and she gave me a whole long story. Now, Lewis Carroll, I think, had similar problems, yes?
Well, that's what we were saying, is that there's something called Alice in Wonderland syndrome, which is a medical diagnosis for people who are having migraine aura where they feel like they're shrinking or growing, and that Lewis Carroll had migraines, and that Alice in Wonderland is considered basically to be the story of a migraine. The aphasia, the gibberish that they speak, the Mad Hatter at the Mad Hatter's tea
There's
party.
There's many symptoms.
Many symptoms. So that's what I was saying, is that the film is not just, you know, misery and pain. It's all of these fascinating aspects of migraine, including the fact, which will interest you, that LSD was originally synthesized as a treatment for migraine.
How'd it work?
So it worked great.
Did you ever give your Emma LSD to treat her migraine?
No, I wish I could have found some. I might have tried it on her.
That'd be an interesting thing to know. We're talking with Susanna Styron and Jackie Oakes, the director and the producer of an amazing new film. Tell us where people can look at this thing. And we only have 10 more minutes, so I really don't want to get into it.
Well, it's not a film. It's a work in progress. It will be a film as soon as we can possibly finish it. But people can see clips from it. They can read about it. On our Kickstarter website, if you go to Kickstarter and search Out of My Head on Kickstarter.com, there's a lot of stuff on there. We're trying to raise enough money to get into the editing room, as we said at the beginning, so that we can get this film made.
I've seen of it, it have tremendous therapeutic value. I did see an astonishing clip you have of a newscaster, a female newscaster, breaking into a report, and she suddenly turns into gibberish. Tell us about that.
Well, that is a symptom of migraine aura. It's aphasia, which happens to many people when they're having a migraine before the headache pain comes on. Which is what, as Jackie was saying, aura is what happens to many, not all, but a certain type of migraine. People have aura, and it can be these flashing lights and all different other sensory symptoms, but aphasia can be one of them. And that's what was happening to Serene Branson, the CBS reporter, on air in that clip.
And what happened to her career after this happened?
She didn't know that she got migraines, so she was terrified when that happened to her. She thought she was having a, you know, brain aneurysm or something. So it was really a scary experience for her.
It was a scary experience watching her, actually.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's devastating. Now, I'm starting to see on, you know, depression was never talked about for decades and decades. And then suddenly some brave people came out and started, like Susanna, like your father in Dark is Visible, the wonderful novel by a novel, not a novel, that wonderful
account
by
Memoir of Madness,
William Styron. And then now suddenly depression is a multi-billion-dollar business with, you know, advertising and all these other things. You know, they want you to sell and take after the 5-minute exposition of all the side effects. Are we starting to see that with migraine, too? Are people marketing drugs for this?
Not yet. I mean, there has only been one new class of drugs developed in the last 20 years for migraine. Triptans, and nothing new has come out since because there's
no basic scientific research. You know, if you're only putting 15 million, when we started making this film, they were literally giving $1 million a year to basic scientific research for headache. And as you probably know, it can take as much as or more than $1 billion to develop a new class of drugs in the pharmaceutical industry. So if the basic research money is not there, which is what the pharmaceutical companies base their drug development on, then you're not going to, the odds of having drug development happen are slim. And the other thing is that very often there are drugs developed for other illnesses that could benefit people with migraine, but if there isn't funding given to do that research, to take a drug that already exists, and particularly a generic drug, like pharma is not going to encourage research of existing drugs if the generic has already come out. So there are generic drugs that could very potentially help migraine, but they're not doing that research because there isn't the funding for that.
And we think that part of the reason for that is that it's primarily a disease of women, and that it's underfunded for that reason. And we've also come to believe in our research that it's because it is, well, for one, you don't die from it. I mean, the thing about migraine is you can't really see it. It's like chronic pain. You don't see it. You can only, and people with migraine tend to retreat. So it's something that is not, and it doesn't kill you. It can ruin your life. And it occasionally, some people actually kill themselves if they have, you know, migraines every day of their lives, which people do. It can ruin your life, but it doesn't, you know, tend to kill you. So it's not an emergency disease. And also because it's so stigmatized, people don't speak up enough about having it and about the need for the drugs. I mean, there are over 36 million just Americans who get, the people in the United States who get migraine. You'd think it would be a big market.
You know, I just saw on the subway today in New York a big ad for liver cancer. It said 600,000 people worldwide get liver cancer. And I went, oh, my God, over 300 million people worldwide get migraine. So you would think there would be some motivation, you know, both on the part of the government and on the part of the pharmaceutical industry to, you know, really dig in to figure out.
There are also many alternative treatments that people can try. There are many things that work for many people. The issue is getting information to people and getting them to ask information for themselves.
Are there any dietary or exercise-oriented things that people do for migraine?
Yes.
My daughter has completely managed her migraines by identifying all of her food triggers and completely avoiding them. So she used to get two migraines a month, which is not considered that much in the migraine world, but it was huge for her. So every 2 weeks she'd have a migraine. Now she gets, maybe two a year, and I'm knocking on wood because migraine is very changeable and anything can happen.
It's important to understand, though, that it's a very individual disease, so everybody has different triggers and different levels of frequency and pain. So what might work for one person is not necessarily likely to work for another. So people have to adapt and learn what their trigger, what it is that like makes it likely to come on, and often that is also changing. That landscape changes, so it's a ever-changing kind of mercurial disease.
It's a moving target for researchers. It's a moving target for people who have it because it's constantly changing. But generally, it's believed that even though probably the last thing on earth you want to do when you're having a migraine is exercise. Is that exercise is turning out to be very helpful for it. We know doctors in clinics who use exercise as a therapy. They also use relaxation techniques, biofeedback.
Acupuncture helps some people. Mm-hmm. So there's a range of things that people can try. Yeah.
It's interesting. I had a situation called tachycardia, where my heart would take off, and I went through over the course of about 6 or 7 years, it would just accelerate for no apparent reason, and I would go through one thing after another that would work, and then stop working, and then the next thing would work and stop working. Have you seen that at all with migraine?
Yeah, that's very, very common in migraine. In fact, it's more likely that something that works for you now may well not work, 3 years from now or 3 months from now. I mean, it is ever changing.
And the neuroscientists who we've spoken with are actually, they're imaging what's going on in the brain now, and they have actually seen that sometimes if you're taking a medication which can block the sort of pathway of electric stimulation across the brain, that it may in fact find a new pathway around what's being blocked. So which would be evidence for why something that you use for a while works and then it stops working.
Wow, this is totally fascinating. I could go on with this, you guys for a while longer, but we will. What else do you want to tell us before we let you go? We occasionally get migraines at our station here, and I hope that.
We want to tell everybody who's listening to please go to Kickstarter.com and search Out of My Head. And consider making a donation to this, because we've got to get this movie made. I think it's going to change many people's lives once it's made, and it's going to be a fascinating film. And we can't do it without a tremendous outpouring of support from, you know, our various communities.
Well, I think it's a great thing you're doing. I love 9/12, and I think this will be a great film, too. I have seen clips. Jackie and Susanna Styron, Jackie Oakes, it's been really an honor to have you on. And
thank
we will
you.
Have you back to check further on the progress of your film. So
great.
Keep in touch
Thanks
with
so
us,
much,
please.
Herbie.
Thank you.
Anytime. Good luck to both
right.
of you.
Bye-bye.
Okay,
bye.
Take care. And we're going to take a short break now. Dana Lyons is going to sing the Solartopia Rocky Top version, and I'm going to be on with Bob Fitrakis, my co-conspirator, to go through all the details of what is breaking with our bought, rigged, stolen, and Jim Crow lynched election. So we'll be right back in a minute or two.
Pipelines, mega dams, Iran, Iraq, Russia, Nigeria, Venezuela, Kurdistan, oil spill, meltdown, flooding, suburbia, mudslide, traffic jam, road rage, asthma, famine, leukemia, it's time to get a better plan. Solartopia is home sweet home.
Yeah, Dana Lyons, Solartopia, the great Rocky Top version from the great Cows with Guns star. More than 2 million views on Cows with Guns at YouTube. Take a look. A vegan, vegetarian anthem from my buddy Dana Lyons. I got my other buddy Bob Fitrakis on the line. Bob, you with us?
I'm here, Harvey.
Okay, that was a very, very interesting half hour on the new film coming out about migraines from Susanna Styron and Jackie Oakes. We'll have them back on. Check on their progress somewhere down the road. Bob, we are on election night. It's Apocalypse Now. We're getting the usual reports that we've been getting since the 2000 election about various fraud, theft, vote rigging, intimidation, lost registrations, donkey ate the ballot box. Tell us what you've been hearing. You are, by way of disclosure, I did vote for you today. You are the lieutenant governor candidate for the Green Party in Ohio. That was the only good moment in my voting career today, was to push the lever for you, and Anita Rios gave me great satisfaction. You were right in between John Kasich, the Republican, and Ed Fitzgerald, the Democrat, so you were kind of a green-powered sandwich there. But tell us what you're hearing now about what's going on election night.
Well, it's some of the usual problems, Harvey. We got a call from Lucas County in Toledo where somebody ran into a light bulb and it popped and it took out all the electricity.
It took out the whole voting station.
Went down because somebody accidentally knocked out a light bulb. And that was always one of your obsessions.
The electricity was so bad. Was that a predominantly Republican or a predominantly Democratic?
Democratic.
Precinct? Democratic, but, of course.
Luckily, because of some of our work here, and it's a Democratic area, they actually had paper ballot backups. A lot of counties don't because they claim it saves money. But you've long said, well, what happened if the electricity goes out?
Well, did they wait in order to use the paper ballots? Did they light candles, and did the candles then set fire to the paper ballots? Is that what happened?
I'm thinking they had to probably break out their cell phones.
Yeah, that's right. That's the new flashlight, isn't it? That's
indeed
fantastic.
Yeah, and also, this is a problem. Ohio is not a photo ID state. But we're getting numerous reports that people are showing up and the poll workers aren't properly trained. And instead of accepting a utility bill or a government check with an address on or car registration, that they're actually demanding, in some cases, a photo ID, which is not the law of this state. So once again, add poll worker training or deliberate sabotage in Democratic districts.
God. Now, you told me something about the FBI being out there.
Yeah, the interesting event, you know, a lot of times we'll be attacked because we'll talk about the possibility of election fraud. GONWIR's news service earlier in on Friday and on Monday, we wrote stuff in the Free Press and gave it to the attorney we were using, Cliff Arnebeck, and he forwarded information on our concern with the election data stream that's coming from certain areas, 63 counties that have had these custom patches put on. And lo and behold, we sent that to the FBI. And yesterday, November 3rd, the U.S. attorney in the state of Ohio, centered in the Columbus area, Carter Stewart, announced and sent out a press release, and he appointed people to three different areas, Columbus, Ohio, Cincinnati, and Dayton. And these people are looking for the following. Here's a quote from the U.S. attorney. Quote, it's our duty to ensure that all qualified voters have the opportunity to cast their ballots and have their votes counted free of discrimination, intimidation, or fraud in the election process. Note that he didn't say that it was voter fraud. He said fraud in the election process.
That means theft. That means theft and rigging voting machines and donkeys eating ballots and stuff like that, right?
No, exactly. And a lot of times we're attacked for suggesting there could be fraud. And, of course, you're always pointing out that other than all of U.S. history, there's nothing to go on.
Yeah, right. We're talking with Bob Fitrakis, my co-conspirator on five or six books. Can't remember how many books we've written, Bob, about this. But we broke most of the major stories coming out of Columbus, Ohio, and the theft of the 2004 election, which John Kerry, of course, walked away from. What are you predicting tonight, Bob? We've, of course, the great work of great Greg Palast. I'm going to have you and Greg on next week when we see when the dust has settled and we see the burial of our democracy fully realized here. What have you been seeing nationally in the lead up to today's vote?
Well, I mean, there's the ridiculous, you know, disenfranchising of more than 500,000 voters in Texas. What you're really seeing in key states like North Carolina, Texas, these Republican-controlled states, that the lack of a voting rights law, the fact that the U.S. Supreme Court took out the formula that allowed us to establish voting rights for all citizens, has now emboldened these reactionary states to openly suppress black and poor voters. And again, let me give you a quote here in Ohio where Carter Stewart, the U.S. attorney, says, quote, protecting the right to vote and combating election fraud are essential to maintaining the confidence of all people in our democratic system of government. Note he actually uses the term election fraud. And what they're doing, and we've written about this, Harvey, is they're first beginning by massively repressing the vote. Many of these so-called red states, particularly the purple states, could not survive. Their first tactic is to disenfranchise as many poor and minority voters as they can in order to get it close. And then when it's close, they can steal the election. And in this case, they really want to steal some key governorships. But more than anything, they want to steal some close races in the U.S. Senate.
And they seem to be pulling it off here. I mean, you know, all these we're hearing all the hype now, which is, you know, typical that the Republicans are going to win. It becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy, obviously, and then it provides them good cover to wreck the vote however they want. But very definitely, we even finally the New York Times has been editorializing about how the GOP's tactics in the lead up to this election have nothing to do with people, you know, voting illegitimately and everything to do with the theft of the elections by the Republican Party.
Well, yeah, no, absolutely, Harvey. First, they control the narrative, and then they suppress the vote because that's the only way that they can win in this situation. And the fact, even the Columbus Dispatch ran an article on mythical creatures like unicorns and voters who commit fraud, because none of the evidence suggests that that's there. And a lot of it was manufactured, Harvey. Think about this. When you go to a poll, the standard that was used in Ohio for long periods of time, and you still have to do this when you sign in, is your signature. Who in the hell is going to go in there and blindly sign somebody's signature? I mean, it's a gold standard, right? You have a very unique signature. I don't know your signature. I'm going to be able to walk in there and write your signature not knowing what it looks like? How is that possible? I mean,
yeah,
there was never any need for photo IDs or IDs. The gold standard is your unique signature. Mine is, you know, backwards letters, strikes across, circled dots. No one in the world, you know, unless you're hiring professional forgery people, but, you know, what are you going to do, go in and blindly sign someone's signature? I mean, all you had to do is compare the signatures. It's worked throughout the history of the Republic. There was no reason to go to the voter IDs other than to suppress people who don't have cars and impose a poll tax on them by forcing them to go and get a driver's license.
Well, let's talk about voter ID now, because it's become a huge voter ID, the demand for voter ID on the state level could, in fact, determine who controls Congress or at least the Senate. And you mentioned 500,000 people being disenfranchised in Texas. This is primarily through the demand for photo ID. And we have noted that in much of the press that in Texas you can legitimately vote with a gun owner's ID, but you can't with a student ID. Where does that come from?
That comes from Texas, boy.
Jesus. Yeah.
You know, I mean, look, in retrospect, I know you're a historian, I'm a political scientist, but we should have let Texas go. I'm not sure it was a wise decision into the Union.
If it hadn't been for the Mexican War, George Bush could have been the president of Texas.
And we could have, you know, surrounded them with good progressives from the rest of the country to keep them from essentially, you know, breaking every law imaginable.
Yeah, well, so where else are they using photo ID to disenfranchise voters?
Well, I mean, the reports out of Indiana and in the last election with the nuns in the Carolinas were looked at closely. You've got a ton of states that are just moving in this direction. And here in Ohio, worse than that, the tactic this time, Harvey, I mean, you've got the blatant states like Texas, but the tactic they're using is the pre-election purges through control of the electronic polling books. So the voting rolls, which are now increasingly here in Ohio, they're under the control of Triad, a hardcore right-to-life family, the Rapp family, owns that company. They were the people who gave us the weird butterfly ballot in Florida. In the vast majority of the counties, the 88 counties, they're programming these books. And, you know, numerous reports, you show up to vote, and it looks like it's tossing off every 10th or 15th Democrat, right, is that you registered to vote, you did everything right, and suddenly you're not there. You're not printed out. And worse than that, you can access these things by Bluetooth. So in no way are they secure. They're easily hackable, and the people maintaining them and writing the algorithms are Republican partisan companies.
Right. So I don't know, you know, and to me, you and I both share the honor, having done this individually, we've written so much stuff together, but you and I separately were both banned from Daily Coast for even mentioning these issues. It's astounding
well,
to me.
Well, this Carter Stewart thing is actually on Daily Coast.
What's that?
They let, I guess when a U.S. attorney writes about voter fraud, they let it actually be put on Daily Coast. When me and you say it, you know, it's not allowed on.
I guess not. But, you know, the Democratic Party has absolutely refused to in any way, shape or form to deal with the reality that with electronic voting machines, you can flip an election just by driving by on the street. It's
drive-by voter fraud. But, Harvey, it's not like, you know, you can hack computers. I mean, it's not like Target or, you know, Morgan Chase or Home Depot and that someone could breach a computer system. That's impossible, Harvey.
Yeah, right. So, and here's what's really impossible, that the Koch brothers and Sheldon Adelson and all these other right-wing multi-billionaires would spend hundreds of millions of dollars to turn an election and would not take the next step to rig the voting machines. I mean, what are people thinking?
No,
they're going to do that.
A lot of this software was created by friends of the CIA, like the Yurisevich brothers. So I'm sure the CIA would never be involved in rigging elections anywhere on Earth.
Well, at least we had the pioneer. I mean, you know, we had the real nitty-gritty George H.W. Bush, who pioneered vote theft, at least in the electronic era with the CIA, and then got himself in the White House. And,
1988, first mention of an upset election, first time people voted on voting machines, Shuptronics, also known as Danaher machines, and that happened in the New Hampshire primary. The first time these machines were used, there was a massive upset. You know, again, Bob Dole's supposed to win by 8% of the vote. Suddenly, Bush is winning by 9. There's been a 17% vote shift in a few days. And again, that was John Sununu, the governor of New Hampshire, that brought those voting machines in 1988.
Yeah, and now they're all over the country. Meanwhile, other countries, such as Canada, Japan, and Germany, and Romania, use hand-counted paper ballots. And Ireland, which had electronic voting machines, ditched them in favor of hand-counted paper ballots.
Mm-hmm. So, absolutely. Had to trash them once they shockingly, when they realized that their exit polls weren't matching the actual vote on the machines, they realized, by God, you can hack a computer. And when people secretly write your software, what is the startling thing, Harvey, is we accept private, partisan, Republican-backed companies to secretly write the software, and then we pretend like there's no way in hell they could manipulate a close election when you've set up a situation which makes it easy to do.
Well, our premise in our most recent piece, 12 Ways that the GOP is already stealing the election. Jim Crow, 12 Ways Jim Crow is already winning in 2014. We had a similar piece in 2004, which really went all over the internet, and so did this one, basically. But they have clearly worked very hard to disenfranchise as many black people as they possibly could. They've been very successful at it, apparently. The outcome of this election. Okay, so we're back. I think Bob's having a little trouble here. We got 5 minutes to go, Bob. We want to talk. How important is it in the outcome of this election in the U.S. Senate? What is all this vote hacking? How much difference do you think it'll make in the key elections for the U.S. Senate seats? And is it possible that the Republican Party actually will take control of the U.S. Senate because of the votes that they've stolen?
Well, you know, I mean, it's a process. It's called, you know, it's first you repress and then you shift. And, you know, so you engage in this Jim Crow massive voter repression, voter ID laws, and they do it in the battleground states that are close. So I think the main reason they get them close is so they can steal them within the margin of error. So, you know, I think that, you know, when you have, we don't know. That's the whole point. We have a system in which private companies, partisan companies, write this software. The assumption is you're only creating a system like that so someone can cheat in a close election. So I think the presumption's got to be if the, you know, Republicans win in a close election, it's because they're manipulating these election systems.
Right, and we already seen so-called, the key word is glitch here. We already seen a glitch in the early voting here in Columbus, Ohio, where allegedly they ran out of bandwidth or whatever they want, whatever little cockamamie scheme they came up with to explain it away. And I'm sure we'll see that all over the country, as we saw in 2004, where George Bush stole his second consecutive election. And now looks like 2016, pretty good chance or pretty bad chance that we'll have Jeb Bush running, doing a rerun on the Bush dynasty.
No, absolutely. And Seidel, I mean, the people that are involved in this area of electronic voting are all partisan, and many of them are connected to the CIA, where George Herbert Walker Bush was the director.
And got his start. Hey, Bob, we're actually out of time. You are a radio show host yourself. Bob Fitrakis, publisher and editor of the freepress.org. Come see our latest piece there, 12 Ways Jim Crow is Winning in 2014. We'll have another piece up tomorrow. It's going to be grim news, I'm afraid. And a week from today, we'll have Greg Palast on with Bob to go further and to sort out the details of the disaster. This has been the Solartopia. Thanks, Bob, for being with us.
All right. Glad to do it.
Solartopia, Green Power and Wellness Show. Thank you to the crew in New York. We will be back again next week in a whole new world.
I started to burn many things we found, but
don't you know we're gonna have a Solartopia, Solartopia, Solartopia. Don't you know we're